Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us here. Remind you on our way to this conversation with Kevin Kamenetz, who is the Baltimore County Executive, of course, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And welcome once again, Kevin Kamenetz, County Executive. Good to have you here.
Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be back. Beautiful, still summer day.
Still very hot summer day.
Yes, it is.
410-319-8888. We've already got a line of callers. We'll get to all these calls. Lily, Ariel, Debbie, don't hang up. We're going to come to you. 410-319-8888. You can also write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages, which I'll check, but call 410-319-8888. So where do we begin? There's so much happening in Baltimore County and the state. So when are you going to announce for governor?
Well, I have 3 years left of my contract,
so wait.
And I am going to serve out the end of my contract.
That's a good political answer. Had to ask that anyway. Beginning at the end of the conversation, it had to come out at some point. So, but let's begin with a couple of things that have been in the news and get to our callers. Lily, you'll be the first caller up, and then we will go to Ariel and then Debbie. And when they canceled the Red Line, and you were still head of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council, right? Which is the council of this Baltimore City and the surrounding counties in the Baltimore Metropolitan area. There were a lot of arguments about why the Red Line may have been a not very well planned out, in many ways. You could argue against parts of the Red Line and structurally speaking. But the idea to cancel it and kill it without any plan about what to do about it, and the role it has in jobs, the role it has in changing the nature of transportation, which is really our metropolitan transportation system for it, in a professional sense, it sucks. it's a bad system. But this at least would have added a different cog to it. Talk a bit about your response to that and what our response has to be. Because now all the money going from Annapolis to transportation is all going to rural counties and rural roads in Eastern Shore and Western Maryland. So what's our response? What is the response?
Well, I think you've summarized it pretty well. First of all, the Red Line was well planned out. And
you had no problem with it all the way it was structured?
Well, all I can tell you is that it was there are always differences of opinion as to the route and the costs and so forth. But the bottom line is that there were many different alternatives that were considered, and the Red Line became the consensus route of the Baltimore region.
Right.
And in essence, everyone said, okay, we've got federal funding lined up here through the great work of Congressman Cummings and our federal partners in Congress, and this is our chance, and this is where we're going to move forward with. The governor, under current structure, certainly has the prerogative to cancel the Red Line, and he did so. Obviously, what caused me great concern was that he did so without performing any real study or analysis. It was almost a knee-jerk response.
And you're clear about that.
Well, I can tell you I met with a group that did a FOIA request, a request for documents, asking for documentation as to what led up to his decision. And they didn't meet the 30-day deadline, but they finally produced some documents at day 48, and none of that showed any type of depth of analysis as to why the Red Line should not be built. So the second part is that Transportation Secretary Ron told a joint committee of the General Assembly, as I was listening to it, that the governor was pressuring him for a deadline to come up with a decision on the Purple Line in the D.C. area, and that when he was preparing that at the last second, according to Secretary Ron, the governor said, "Oh, by the way, I want your answer on the Purple on the Red Line as well." And he gave that to him, in essence, the next day. So I'm reasonably convinced that there was no real adequate discussion in the administration before pulling the plug on the Red Line that showed empirical studies or a real thoughtful analysis. and for the governor to say, well, this is a boondoggle, was a very broad statement, which unfortunately I think locked in his position. But he pulled the plug. He's the governor. He had that prerogative at this stage. So the issue for me is, where's your plan B? You can't just say, I'm going to kill the red line and then transfer 99% of the money that was to be devoted to mass transit in Baltimore City and Baltimore County and disperse it to the rural regions. And again, without any real vetting of those particular road projects. I mean, to expand 404 off of Route 50, without it, a commensurate increase in the lanes on the Delaware side is kind of silly. So you reach Delaware, now it's two lanes again. So why are we investing all this money on the Maryland side? And of course, some say, well, why are we investing money to send people out of state, which that road is designed to do? The one in Garrett County, the same thing. It sends people to West Virginia. Doesn't necessarily serve the needs of commuters. So look, he did it. He didn't have, it's clear he doesn't have a plan B, and he dispersed all the money. So what I did was to say, look, this calendar year, I'm the chair of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council. They are a nonpartisan group. And when we talk about the region, it's not just Baltimore City and Baltimore County who are members of the BMC, but it's also Anne Arundel County, Howard County, Harford County, and Carroll County.
But politically, people can all sit and wait for the governor to make a decision and to question. But what do you do? What does the mayor do? What do we do?
Well, that's my point.
What is the point?
Well, my point is that's why I have asked the BMC, who has a professional staff, to start analyzing what alternatives are out there. So, in essence, for us to do the job of coming up with a plan B, and I'd like to have some kind of consensus and recommendations in place before the next General Assembly session begins in January so that we can start addressing some of the recovering or recapturing some of the lost funding to achieve some of these goals. And I'm we have a great staff there. They're professionals. They've been involved in transportation planning for a while. And I'm not giving them specific direction in that regard, but it's pretty obvious that you can come up with different ideas. You can run a spur off of the existing hard rail line that leads to Social Security Administration. You could make better use of Lexington Market as the transportation hub, where it already aligns with both the light rail and the heavy rail. You could do a spur off to Canton. You could actually extend the hard rail line from Hopkins to Bayview. You know, there are a lot of different options that could be considered, but the real issue is just to cancel the red line still leaves us stuck in traffic and doesn't allow employees to have greater access to transportation that they need.
So let's open the phones here, and we'll come back to many other issues we're going to talk to County Executive Kevin Kamenetz about in the course of this next hour. Please join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. And Kevin, if you need to fiddle with your levels, it's right there. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Lily. You're the first caller up on line one. Welcome.
Hi. I want to first off thank Mr. Kamenetz for his support of air conditioning in our public schools. And I'm part of a group that is really fighting for a heat closure policy in Baltimore County because we believe that having teachers and children in classrooms that are upwards of 100 degrees is really amounts to institutional child abuse. And we're happy that the schools have closed the last 2 days and closed early. But the question I have is, I was reading a transcript, which was a conversation between the comptroller, Peter Francho, and Dr. Dan. And the comptroller seemed to indicate that it was Mr. Kamenetz and Dr. Dan who were standing in the way of portable AC units in schools that don't have them as a Band-Aid until the central air conditioning could put in. And I would like to know, what is the reason why portable air conditioning units cannot be used in our schools when Anne Arundel County schools have been using them for the last 10 years?
Thanks, Lily. It's a great question. Let me just, before I answer you directly, I just want to give a little overview of where we are with air conditioning. When I took office in 2010, 52% of Baltimore County schools were un-air conditioned. And that's simply a factor that 80% of our schools are more than 40 years old. And it gets back to the factor that as a county, we grew up in the 50s and 60s, and that's when most of our schools were built. And they were built without air conditioning. Well, since in those 5 years, we have constructed or have funding in place already, air conditioning of schools, and that number is now being reduced from 52% to 15%. We have a 10-year program, a $1.3 billion commitment that will reduce the number or will air condition 99% of all of our schools within this 10-year period. Almost 70% of those dollars come from the county. So normally the state would match us 1-to-1. We've been doing 2-to-1. So obviously we would like to do more faster if the state would kind of kick in and match us dollar for dollar, but they haven't. That being said, I know the controller likes to talk about that it would be more cost efficient to use window units. Here's our analysis quite simply, and we're not locked into it, but you know, it still could be a factor for certain schools. But most of these schools that are 50 and 60 years old do not have the wiring to handle room air conditioners. So we could come in and we would have to upgrade all of the electricity to handle those. But I will tell you that would then be a short-term solution, which would then push that school to the bottom of the renovation list. So that
so what's the percentage now of schools that are air conditioned?
With the ones we currently have under construction as well in Catonsville, 85%. So we're going from 48% air condition to 85% air condition within 5 years, within that 5 years I've been in office, and we will achieve the goal by 2021.
So before going to the next caller, and there's a lot of callers calling about schools, we'll get to all of you and other callers as well with other issues. So what about the closure policy that she was asking about?
Well, that's a function, obviously, of the school system and the superintendent. And, you know, I don't get involved in that. That's up to the superintendent to make that determination and from a policy perspective. And he responded yesterday. And you know, look, they've got to consider school closing. It's interesting. So 85% of the schools or 80% that have air conditioning now got off early yesterday, even though they had air conditioning. So it's a tough decision for the superintendent. He also has to validate, take into consideration the snow days and the school schedule. But I just want to tell you, Lily, I get what you're saying. It's hot out there. I know it makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the children to be in a proper learning environment. We're all about that, and we're not just focusing on air conditioning when we go in these schools. We're also talking about modernizing the environment in terms of Wi-Fi technology and other aspects that to improve that learning environment, as well as provide public safety in our schools, which we've also enhanced in terms of school security and buzzers and cameras. So it's a host of issues that we try and address with this $1.3 billion. It's not just air conditioning, which is why it takes so long and why it costs so much money.
Back to the phones with 410-319-8888. Linwood, you're on the air.
Good morning, County Executive. How you doing?
Good morning.
Okay, my name is Linwood Jackson. I'm a 40-year resident of Turner Station. And Turner Station being one of, if not the last, larger African-American community, I just would like to know what the plan is. I attend the conservation meeting on a regular basis. And when in March, when I heard that the conservation team is the representative for Turner Station through Baltimore County, I was kind of shocked because we have churches, we have other organizations. Now, my question is to you, sir, is how do we understand the plan? And Turner Station is changing because with people moving out of East Baltimore and finding Turner Station very comfortable to live in, I think they need to survey the community again to find out what our needs are versus the plan that was in place in 2000. 2006.
Linwood, you live in a great, venerable neighborhood. We have probably 36 historic African-American communities in Baltimore County that have a rich history, and Turner Station is one of those vibrant communities that still exist today. We've put a lot of money into Turner Station and in the last couple of years. We obviously tore down the high school and then built the brand-new Dundalk Sollers Point High School, $101 million combined building. And in its place of the old Sollers Point, we have built a beautiful recreational facility that has indoor and outdoor facilities, a library branch there, a beautiful park and playground and playing fields. We're also working to rehab some of the failing properties there. We're in the process right now of acquiring a couple of them that we're going to tear down and then market for new construction right in the neighborhood. And we do have this committee that we work with. I know we do involve the faith-based community. I know Reverend Dred Scott's involved in that and other groups. So at Linwood, I think our failure is that we're not involving you in this committee, and I'd like to be able to do that.
So, I mean, the question that the Linwood was talking about, I mean, when it comes to places like Turner Station and the other black communities where things have already happened, where they've been developers come in and the communities have changed drastically, nothing done to really preserve those communities, and wealth has moved in because it's a lot of them on beautiful sites, like Turner Station, like parts of Dundalk. A friend of mine, Dundalk, was telling me recently how they were trying to push him off of his, out of his trailer and off of his waterfront property so they can build something in that place, and there's a lot of pressure. So what do you do to ensure that working families and old working class families remain in their communities and are not pushed out by developers who just want to come in and just take over the entire property and move people out?
I haven't seen that gentrification of Turner Station, so I would love to see more activity in terms of new housing there. I think that's really what we're trying to encourage. But I think your Dundalk friend is talking about the waterfront properties.
Yes, right.
That, you know, it's a fair issue. You know, don't take away my little slice of heaven, and I get that.
But it's more than that, because I think policies happen in Baltimore, whether it's Baltimore City or Baltimore County, but Baltimore County we're talking about today, have never really instituted policies with teeth that are inclusionary, that ensure that if a developer is going to develop something, that X percent of the houses have to go to moderate and or low-income families, and making that stick like they've done in Montgomery County over the years. Why can't Baltimore County do the same so you don't move people out? And people actually can stay in the communities they are within. You also can do things in terms of, well, let me just leave it there.
I don't think we are seeing that gentrification, so to speak, the way you just described it. I don't think that that's really happening in Baltimore County. I think there are areas that are becoming more favored and popular now. But in the sense of people getting squeezed out, I don't really get that sense. However, you have brought a bigger issue, and that is, should Baltimore County have some type of inclusionary housing process in place that is a set-aside where you are allowing people of lower income than the average homeowner or renter at that point
but you think
to
that,
also live in that same complex?
But do you think that all development that we have, no matter where it is, should have inclusionary policies allow for that? So we disperse low income.
Okay, and that's the key, is to disperse low income. So you have to create these opportunity areas where what I'll call non-impacted areas, the areas that aren't majority poor already. That, to me, I think has the greatest opportunity to do it. The challenge in Baltimore County is that we are, as I indicated before, a mature county. We are built out. Remember, two-thirds of our county geographically and in an area where you live is environmentally protected, is on well and septic and not on public water and sewer, has no transportation opportunities, and has some of the most conservative zoning in the country, one house every 50 acres. So that leaves, and 80% of our population live on 30% of the land. So that leaves the area, obviously, inside the Beltway and then around the Beltway. That's the one-third of the county that's left. And basically, much of the county is already built out. Now, what we have done is most recently, last year, we created a housing fund that will have $10 million in it, and we've or $30 million, and we've jump started it, I believe, with $10 million now. And that fund is available to a developer based upon a discretionary review on our part that we're hitting a non-impacted area to buy down certain units that could then be used for workforce housing or affordable housing.
Well, let me go back to the phones here before we go to break and come back to
these. And that's something new that we haven't really publicized that enough. But that's a big deal for Baltimore County to have that kind of funding in place.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We're going to go to Joe, and then after we come back from break, we'll hit Ariel, who's also been holding on for a long time. But Joe, you're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I live in the North County, and I've been involved in preservation activities for decades now. And, of course, the North County's under tremendous pressure for development. One of the things which has happened recently is the county has approved and supported the installation of a 24-hour Royal Farm store in the village of Hereford, one of the only two villages that's reserved according to the Baltimore County comprehensive zoning map. And the people in this area have been fighting this for, 18 months now. And there, a petition was signed with almost 1,300 signatures against this, and notwithstanding that, the county supported it. And the county came out in favor of it before all of the studies were done by independent hydrologists and urban planners and what have you. So basically what's happening is Hereford is being turned into something of a truck stop with a 24-hour, well-lit, diesel gas station that's, convenience store and all. And our county councilman has been fighting this, but unsuccessfully. So I was wondering, and we also, I'm sorry to say that we have come to the conclusion that many of the people in the county planning offices who are most supportive of the citizenry have been transferred out and placed in positions which make them largely irrelevant. So I guess what I'm asking the county executive is how it is that the county can support this kind of development in the face of popular support against it, and involving something which is sort of utterly unneeded in this little village that is supposed to be a village, not supposed to be a truck stop.
So, Joe, let me ask you to hold on. Don't hang up. We have to take a very brief break, and we come back from the break. The county executive can respond. You can stay on the phone and hear what's happening and respond as well. Ariel will be the next caller up. We have an email here from Allie that we'll also read and also jump into issues around planning and zoning, but also around questions of growing cannabis in the county. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're here with Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz at 410-319-8888. Let's jump right back to the County Executive to respond to Joe's question about Hereford and the Royal Farm Store and changing the nature of that rural town.
Hey, Joe, thanks for your comments. First of all, I'm very proud of the record we have in Baltimore County. We're approaching the 50th year of the urban-rural demarcation line, and that's what we talked about the two-thirds of the county being zoned rural in nature. And I think we've done a great job over these last 50 years of ensuring that vision that was in place when the URDL was enacted is still largely intact now. That being said, there are clearly different areas where developments can take place outside the URDL where you live, that decision-making process rests with the Baltimore County Council. So your prior councilman, Todd Huff, it's my understanding, rezoned that site to allow the Royal Farms there.
One of the reasons he lost the election.
By right. Well, it could be, but he did it by right, and that then becomes the law. So it's not the county doing this. It's the law that now says it based upon county council action.
But what about you as county executive when a majority of a community like that in that whole area says, no, we don't want this.
Okay, we are a nation of laws. When the county council once every 4 years passes the comprehensive zoning map process, that's a public process and a bill, and the council members are lobbied by developers and by the community. Those are decisions that are in place for the next 4 years. Our job as the executive branch is to enforce the laws. That's the law in place. So that means that if the developer owns land and it's zoned a particular way and that developer otherwise dots all the I's and crosses all the T's, they are entitled to develop their property according to the law that's then in place. It doesn't prevent Councilman Koch from next year in the 2016 map process from downzoning that process. And, you know, I guess it becomes a race to who gets the shovel in the ground fast enough.
So I wonder if there's something wrong with the process. I mean, I say this for this reason. No matter what part of the county you live in, it's usually the council person in that district has his or her way, and the rest of the council people should go along with his or her way because it's in their district. And then developers have a huge – I always call the developers in our world of local and state politics, especially local politics, as the defense contractors of Capitol Hill, the kind of power they can wield to make people change and do what they want. And a lot of stuff was changed because of that and against the will of
when
the most
– When you say
of
that, listen, no one wants development. Everyone's against development.
Because developers in Baltimore City, Baltimore County, wherever you go, get their way because they have the money and political muscle to get their way, which is either getting write-offs for land, getting land cheap, the communities often suffer as a result.
I don't think you're giving enough credit to the council members who almost sit as a judge and weigh and consider the various factors, because ultimately. You're right, and as Joe mentioned, who his councilman is, and you said you believe that's why Todd Huff lost the election.
Yeah.
Well, then the voters did respond, and the voters did have their say. So they were upset with the decision, that you believe that Todd made, and he suffered as a result of that. Well, that's what every council member is going to have to consider in that weighing and balancing. But I want you to think about something: we have not raised the property tax rate in 27 years. We have not raised the income tax rate in 23 years. We have no town taxes. We have no fire tax, no energy tax, no additional set of fee like that. If we want to maintain a stable tax rate and build and air-conditioned schools and maintain a strong police and fire department, we have to expand our tax base. And there are areas where new development expands the tax base. Look at downtown Towson. Guess what? The people in downtown Towson, inside the Beltway, the people who've lived there for generations, they are upset about all the new development taking place in downtown Towson. So inside the Beltway, it's the same comment that Joe has. We don't want, and in fact, it's a Royal Farms. At York and Bosley, we don't want a 24-hour Royal Farms on York and Bosley.
And the same fight against Royal Farms is taking place in Baltimore City on Hartford Road.
Although, I kind of like their chicken.
I'm not going to go into their chicken because I hear too much about their chicken. I don't eat their chicken, but that's just me. 410-319-8888. Let me go back to the phones here. We're going to go to Ariel and read this email. Ariel, on line two, you're on the air. I've been holding on for a long time. Welcome.
I know. Let me say, I love Royal Farm fries.
What is it about that Royal Farm fries and chicken?
Thank you for having me. I was actually along the same lines as Lily, so you kind of answered some of my questions. So I will be having to bug Superintendent Dallas Dance about mandatory heat and such. Still not understanding why, since my elementary school has air conditioning wall units for the office and things, but not for the classroom. It's just a little agitating. So I'm curious, do you think if all the parents keep being the squeaky wheel, keep bothering our government officials, bringing more stuff to light, bringing our sick children home early, what do you think about if we start petitioning, fundraising. Will we make a difference, maybe make things go a little faster?
Ariel, you've already convinced me. I knew that when I was elected in 2010 that we had to address the issue, and I'm working as rapidly as we can. And again, I just want to show those statistics. It was 52% unair-conditioned when I took office 5 years ago. It is now, with those under construction or with funding in place, going to be 15% unair-conditioned, and we hope to get the job done within this full 10-year time frame by 2020, in the next couple years. So I can't put any more money in than I've already put, and I want to give you a sense of what we're doing. We have now we're asking the voters to double and triple the amount of voter referenda for education, for school construction, than they have ever approved in the past. And this last November, the voters did approve that, and we're going to do that for the next two bond referenda. So we are up against our self-imposed debt limit of where we can go with school construction. We're putting all our monies into the school construction pot here, so to speak. So we're on it. We're still doing it while maintaining stable tax rate without raising the taxes, and we're getting the job done, which frankly should have been done sooner, but I'm recognizing it. We're there. I'm sorry that there's still going to be some students who are suffering in the next couple of years, but it's all in the pipeline.
So I know that any political leader in this world, especially in the state of Maryland, is loath to talk about taxes or raising taxes or doing anything with taxes. But how can Baltimore County continue without raising taxes? Without raising property tax, there was always this public battle between you and Dance over the budget when he announced he wanted more money, which is almost an anathema in Baltimore County politics for a superintendent to say something when the county executive doesn't want that to happen. It happened under Rupesberger. It happened under you.
But it happens in every county of the state.
But what I'm saying is, when you have a rise in people, you have a rise in – let's just take education for a moment. You have a rise in Baltimore County of low-income children in schools. You have a rise in Baltimore County of children who are English as a second language. That's a burgeoning. Both populations are growing. Poverty is growing in Baltimore County, even at a faster rate than it is growing in Baltimore City. Not actual numbers.
And you've got a rise in every measurable positive statistic in the school system at the same time.
But how can the county in the long term continue without raising taxes to meet those needs and other needs in the county?
Okay. All I can tell you is I can only address the time frame in which I am county executive. So I have 2 4-year contracts, and I'm in year 5 of 8, and I'm managing the way I think the citizens want me to. I am disturbed by a mantra that perhaps is in Annapolis or even Washington somehow, that government has to, you know, cut the line on taxes and cut out programs. My message here is in Baltimore County that we can be fiscally conservative and achieve good things through government. And that's been our record. So while we've had the stable tax rate, I'm also making this monumental commitment to school construction and renovation. We're doing that within our existing tax structure. What the needs, and we have a great social service net. We just opened up a men's homeless shelter at the grounds of Spring Grove on the west side. We're about to open, that was a $6 million facility. We're about to open a $24 million transitional housing facility on the grounds of Franklin Square Hospital. You know, we're meeting our, as best we can, our social service safety net. But at the same time, we're doing it in a fiscally conservative or responsible way, I guess is the better way of saying it.
On the way back to the phones, let me read this email from Allie. Allie writes in, losing the red line was indeed unfortunate, but the plan B should be something simple. Increase the number of buses on all the lines. Presently, most bus lines run only 1 to 2 buses per hour. All bus lines should be run at least every 10 minutes. I am not talking about the problems with missed buses. I'm talking about the schedule as it is. Major lines along Charles Street, for instance, will run only every 20 to 30 minutes. This is not usable for the average people. If you increase the budget for more buses and more bus drivers so that the lines run every 10 minutes, you would help the way more people. You would help way more people than the red line ever would have helped, and spend way less money.
All right. Well, Allie, the governor is not going to increase the budget for buses. And in fact, he's kind of, you know, he referred to the Baltimore City as a bus town or bus people. He thinks that he can improve the service of the bus system without adding additional funds. First of all, it's the state's responsibility to improve the bus system. And obviously, it's common sense stuff, you know. First of all, you need transponders that allow people to know exactly where each bus is so they can go on an app and find out when that bus is going to arrive. You need to put Wi-Fi on public transit, which is something I think people would enjoy as a perk, so to speak. The timing of buses, is a cost factor that they're going to have to consider. I think there are a lot of improvements that they can make as part of their job, the MTA, as part of their job in running this bus system that they haven't made in the past. But I think the broader question is, how do we expand ridership? And look at the circulator. And I'm watching this free circulator that the city's paying for and seeing how popular it is. And I'm trying to understand why, because you're attracting people who would not normally ride a bus, and they're agreeing to ride a bus. So I think we need to start analyzing, how do we expand the number of riders? Why is it that they want to ride this circulator bus but not an MTA bus? So, those are the kind of questions I would want to be asking if I were running the MTA.
410-319-8888. I promised Joe a follow-up. I'll come back to him in a minute, but let's go back to the phones here. Ariel, Crystal on line three, you've been holding on a long time.
Hi.
Hi, Crystal.
I'm calling again about the Baltimore County school closure policy. I'd really like to know if something is going to be put in place as a Band-Aid, because I feel like we need a Band-Aid. I'm reading the letter that your office made yesterday, and it says that 20% are without air conditioning, and unfortunately, my children are in one of those schools with asthma. So, they come out of school completely soaked, can't hardly breathe, can't participate half the time in recess, and I feel like we need a Band-Aid. We need something in the classrooms to cool these kids off, because they're obviously not having productive days.
Yeah, it's a cost factor, Crystal. I don't know what elementary school you're discussing, but I can tell you that if the school system goes in there and puts something in the short term, it pushes them to the bottom of the list in terms of long-term solution. We're talking about
fans.
I don't know why they can't do that. That is kind of common sense, you would think. But I don't know what the electrical component of that is. But the bottom line is that I think there's a safety issue, believe it or not, in this world we live in about fans.
Fingers.
Yeah. It's crazy now the way we have to be so worried about everything. But, we're talking 2 weeks in September and we're talking 2 weeks in June.
Let me ask quick. We're going to go to the phones here and get a response, and also go to another caller coming. It's jammed. We're not going to be able to get to everybody. I apologize. Get to as many people as we can on these phones. But what is the argument taking place in the county council now around growing medical cannabis in Baltimore County, between doing it inside the urban and the urban areas, only in industrial zones, or outside in the more rural areas? And some people don't want it because they're afraid that the aroma may float into their homes. So what is the
I think it's kind of silly. Look, here's the bottom line. I'm taking a very pragmatic view here. The Maryland General Assembly has passed a law indicating that medical marijuana will be allowed in this state to help people who are seriously ill, that a doctor has to write a prescription for it, and then they set up a system where there will be 15 cultivators throughout the state. There will be X number of processors who will then turn it into a product, and then there will be up to 2 per senatorial districts. That's 2 times 47, 94 possible commissaries that would dispensaries that would dispense it. So we felt that the General Assembly has spoken. Our approach is to treat this no different than any other controlled drug that is authorized for sale, and similar to a hospital or a pharmacy. So we thought we could handle within existing zoning law. The county council chose to regulate it a little further by passing a zoning description of it. I don't care where the cultivation takes place, because I know we like to think that, you know, Baltimore County is still agrarian, and it is. But my understanding is that all of this growing is going to take place in a warehouse under, you know, sun lamps, kind of what, you know, people were doing. You knew those people in the basement of their homes.
I knew those people. What are you trying to say there, Kevin? I knew those people.
Way back when. So it doesn't matter where it takes place, in my opinion. I guarantee you they're going to be heavily guarded, and no one's going to be able to get near them in any way, shape, or form.
Before we have to go to our city paper segment, we only have a few minutes left. I do want to get to some of the callers here. Let's go to very quickly to line one. Netta on line one. Try to get a couple calls in here before we have to end the conversation. Netta?
Yes. Hello.
Good morning.
Mr. Kamenetz, getting back to the question of the earlier caller, Joe, he was speaking about the Royal Farms issue, and you had indicated that it was the doing of Mr. Huck who had the zoning changed at the request of the developer.
I believe that's right.
Yes. Well, there was a slight zoning change, which did enable them to put the gas pumps in the front, but the county agencies, and you are the head of the whole county, the county planning department did support the Royal Farms going in there. And there was no community input allowed prior to the hearing before the administrative law judge. It was not by right. It was by special exception. And there are many hoops that they have to jump through because this is a gas station. They did have support from the county, and the county did sign off on it. And the community was not consulted, and the community was overwhelmingly against it. There were a few people that were for it, very few. And those people were, like I said, they were in the minority.
So, Linda, I'm sorry to interrupt, Netta. I just want to let the county executive respond.
Netta,
because of timing.
Yeah, the bottom line is it's not up to the county to offer an opinion as to each individual use. The county has to enforce the broader concept of the zone, and then is this a permitted use as defined within that zone, and that's what this case is. The county doesn't take positions on a individual product. That's not our purview. That's up to the council when they create the overall zone. There is a special exception requirement generally for gas stations, but I will tell you that's just a little heightened sense of review. As we lawyers like to say, there's nothing special about a special exception. It's just the extra level of scrutiny that might be required, but it's not unusual to be granted a special exception.
Let me see if we can slide one more caller in here before we have to run out. We don't have – you saying no? That's too bad. There's a lot of people here, and we had to go to our next segment, which is coming up, which is the Baltimore City Paper. So all the other callers, Tim and Joe again and Ariel, sorry we could not get to all your calls here with Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County Executive. Let me thank you, Kevin, for coming in the studio again.
Hey, we've covered pot and chicken and chicken in every pot. There we go.
Chicken. I think that was in the 1920s. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Good to see you.
We have to take a very quick break and come back. And as we do, we will be talking with Anna Walsh of the Baltimore City Paper to see what's in this week's issue.